lies mostly in ruins. It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it.
Now, that may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike.
Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at houses, just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Jaromír Severodonetsk.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, there might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialise.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British capital is boiling with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, That's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg Climate Dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Syed Purizza, London.
Mashhad, a tourist magnet in northeast Iran. Every year, some 30 million pilgrims from across the Muslim world travel to Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. But a few miles away from the shrine, there's a whole new world for tourists who would also like to enjoy natural resorts after a spiritual journey. Welcome to Kuh Sangi, a heaven at the heart of Mashhad, as described by this Iraqi family.
We come from Iraq. We visited the holy shrine of Imam Reza, and then I found about this amazing place called Kuh Sangi and came with my family to enjoy the scenery.
It's my second trip to Mashhad. The city offers you a whole traveling package that includes pilgrimage and recreation.
Kuh Sangi is one of a myriad of attractions in Mashhad. Natural resorts such as Shandiz and Chali Dara Valley, and recreational centers such as Water Waves Land and Iram Amusement Park are among the must-see places in Mashhad. The city is also home to 10,000 historical sites. Only 1,500 of those sites have so far been registered and developed for tourists.
One of the major attractions of Mashhad is its restaurants and street eateries. Mashhad is the city of foods. It has numerous restaurants serving a variety of local and international foods. Mashhad also has more than 680 parks, providing a chance for visitors to entertain themselves besides their pilgrimage.
Mashhad is also a hotspot for health tourism in the region. Only in 2021, over 24,000 health tourists visited the city, mainly from Iraq and Oman, earning the city roughly $48 million. Authorities in Mashhad say the potentials are countless, but so are the challenges. To foreign visitors, Mashhad is still a religious-only city, and many are not aware of its recreational capacities.
We at the municipality are trying to raise awareness of the attractions in Mashhad. One of those efforts is the launching of the English version of our website, which guides foreign travelers through the city online. We will soon launch the Arabic webpage as well.
Due to the large number of visitors throughout the year, Mashhad has one of the best-equipped public transport systems in the country. It has a growing subway network and bus rapid transit system, beside other transportation services, making it easy to access the desired tourist destinations in the city.
Known as the spiritual capital of Iran, Mashhad seems to offer more than a spiritual experience to visitors. With its spectacular natural resorts and growing number of recreational centers, Mashhad municipality plans to turn the city into a tourist hub in the region. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Mashhad.
Yet another wave of COVID-19 is hitting South Korea, with cases doubling to 40,000 per day in the past week. The BA.5 Omicron subvariant accounts for almost a third of the new cases, a portion that is increasing. While experts recognize vaccines may not always prevent infection, they decrease illnesses and deaths.
Even people who have been infected with Omicron before are not able to develop enough immunity to this variant unless they are vaccinated. People who have been fully vaccinated and boosted but become infected have reduced chances of severe illness of 70 to 90%.
The fatality rate of COVID-19 has dropped to near the seasonal flu. Still, experts argue that changed behaviors of mask wearing and routine vaccinations should remain in place. The recent spike in COVID-19 cases here comes as South Korea Thursday detects the first case of BA.2.75, nicknamed Centaurus. Scientists worry this highly mutated Omicron variant is even more transmissible than previous strains. Some want stronger antivirus enforcement, suggesting public apathy risks another COVID-induced economic downturn. People are required to wear masks on transit, but the government has said it will not implement lockdowns. People over 50 will be offered fourth vaccinations next week. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A debate in the European Parliament has heard that 22% of people in the EU are struggling to make ends meet. That's almost 100 million citizens who are counting every cent. Apparently, sending weapons to Ukraine is not the answer.
The best way to deal with the cost of living crisis is to stop prolonging the war. The people of Europe favour peace, even well above punishing Russia.
EU financial markets are in turmoil. There are calls for the introduction of a windfall tax.
Energy prices and food prices are going through the roof. Capitalists make profits by speculating on markets and thereby hurting millions of households.
Members of the public have been talking to us about the current state of the EU's economy.
It's terrifying to see that our free market is like collapsing. All the money that we are going to send to Ukraine, then we will have to need this money, and where we are going to take this money from.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has been singled out for criticism in the European Parliament.
We talk now about the increase of cost of living in the European Union, which is just a result of the insane and unsound policies promoted by the European Union since Ursula von der Leyen took office.
There have been calls for greater solidarity between EU member states to deal with the cost of living crisis.
In order to make sure that we are not at the end dividing Europe in those who are able to help and those who have more difficulties.
On sanctions against Russia, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said, quote, "Initially I thought that we had only shot ourselves in the foot, but now it is clear that the EU economy has shot itself in the lungs and is gasping for air." Many here agree. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, climate change and rapid population growth are shrinking the Great Salt Lake, creating a bowl of toxic dust that could poison the air around Salt Lake City. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Christopher Falvell. The piece is titled, "As the Great Salt Lake Dries Up, Utah Faces an Environmental Nuclear Bomb." If the Great Salt Lake in the United States, which has already shrunk by two-thirds, continues to dry up, here's what's in store. The lake's flies and brine shrimp would die off. Scientists warn it could start as soon as this summer, threatening the 10 million migratory birds that stop at the lake annually to feed on the tiny creatures. Ski conditions at the resorts above Salt Lake City, a vital source of revenue, would deteriorate. The lucrative extraction of magnesium and other minerals from the lake could stop. Most alarming, the air surrounding Salt Lake City, Utah, would occasionally turn poisonous. The lake bed contains high levels of arsenic, and as more of it becomes exposed, windstorms carry that arsenic into the lungs of nearby residents, who make up three-quarters of Utah's population. We have this potential environmental nuclear bomb that's going to go off if we don't take some pretty dramatic action, said Joel Ferry, a Republican state lawmaker and rancher who lives on the north side of the Great Salt Lake. As climate change continues to cause record-breaking drought, there are no easy solutions. Saving the Great Salt Lake would require letting more snow melt from the mountains flow to the lake, which means less water for residents and farmers. That would threaten the region's breakneck population growth and high-value agriculture, something that state leaders seem reluctant to do. Utah's dilemma raises a core question as the country heats up. How quickly are Americans willing to adapt to the effects of climate change, even if those effects become urgent, obvious, and potentially catastrophic? The stakes are alarmingly high, according to Timothy Hawks, a Republican lawmaker who wants more aggressive action. Otherwise, he said, the Great Salt Lake risks the same fate as California's Owens Lake, which went dry decades ago, producing the worst levels of dust pollution in the United States and helping to turn the nearby community into a veritable ghost town. It's not just fear-mongering, he said, of the lake vanishing. It can actually happen. Say you climbed into a car at the edge of the Pacific Ocean and started driving east, tracing a line across the middle of the United States. After crossing the Klamath and Cascade Mountains in Northern California, green and lush, you would reach the Great Basin Desert of Nevada and western Utah. In one of the driest parts of the United States, the landscape is a brown so pale it's almost grey. But keep going east, and just shy of Wyoming, you would find a modern oasis. A narrow strip of green, stretching some 100 miles from north to south, home to an uninterrupted metropolis beneath snow-capped mountains, sheltered under maple and pear trees. At the edge of that oasis, between the city and the desert, is the Great Salt Lake. Utahns called the metropolis the Wasatch Front, after the 12,000-foot Wasatch Range above it. Extending roughly from Provo in the south to Brigham City in the north, with Salt Lake City at its center, it's one of the fastest-growing urban areas in the United States, home to 2.5 million people, drawn by the natural beauty and relatively modest cost of living. That megacity is possible because of a minor hydrological miracle. Snow that falls in the mountains just east of Salt Lake City feeds three rivers, the Jordan, the Weber, and the Bear, which provide water for the cities and towns of the Wasatch Front, as well as the rich cropland nearby, before flowing into the Great Salt Lake. Until recently, that hydrological system existed in a delicate balance. In summer, evaporation would cause the lake to drop about 2 feet in level. In spring, as the snowpack melted, the rivers would replenish it. Now two changes are throwing that system out of balance. One is explosive population growth, diverting more water from those rivers before they reach the Great Salt Lake. The other shift is climate change, according to Robert Gillies, a professor at Utah State University and Utah State climatologist. Higher temperatures cause more snowpack to transform to water vapor, which then escapes into the atmosphere rather than turning to liquid and running into rivers. More heat also means greater demand for water for lawns and crops, further reducing the amount that reaches the Great Salt Lake. And a shrinking lake means less snow. As storms pass over the Great Salt Lake, they absorb some of the moisture, which then falls as snow in the mountains. A vanishing lake endangers that pattern. If you don't have water, Dr. Robert Gillies says, you don't have industry, you don't have agriculture, and you don't have life. Last summer, as the water level in the Great Salt Lake reached its lowest point on record, and it's likely to fall further even this year, the lake's surface area, which covered about 3,300 square miles in the late 1980s, has since shrunk to less than 1,000 square miles, according to U.S. Geological Survey. The salt content in the part of the lake closest to Salt Lake City used to fluctuate between 9% and 12%, according to Bonnie Baxter, a biology professor at Westminster College. But as the water in the lake drops, its salt content has increased. If it reaches 17%, something that Dr. Baxter says will happen this summer, the algae in the water will struggle, threatening the brine shrimp that consume it. While the ecosystem hasn't collapsed yet, Dr. Baxter says, we're at the precipice, and it's terrifying. The long-term risks are even worse. One morning in March, Kevin Perry, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Utah, walked out onto land that used to be underwater. He picked at the earth, the color of dried mud, like a beach whose tide went out and never came back. The soil contains arsenic, antimony, copper, zirconium, and other dangerous heavy metals, much of it residue from mining activity in the region. Most of the exposed soil is still protected by a hard crust. But as wind erodes the crust over time, those contaminants become airborne. Clouds of dust also make it difficult for people to breathe, particularly those with asthma or other respiratory ailments. Dr. Perry pointed to shards of crust that had come apart, lying on the sand like broken china. This is a disaster, Dr. Perry said, and the consequences for the ecosystem are absolutely insanely bad. In theory, the fix is simple. Let more water from melting snowpack reach the Great Salt Lake by sending less water towards homes, businesses and farms. But metropolitan Salt Lake City has barely enough water to support its current population, and it is expected to grow almost 50% by 2060. The worst-case scenario for the Great Salt Lake is neither hypothetical nor abstract. Rather, it's on display 600 miles southwest, in a narrow valley at the edge of California, where what used to be a lake is now a barely contained disaster. In the early 1900s, Los Angeles, growing fast and running out of water, bought land along either side of the Owens River, then built an aqueduct diverting the river's water 230 miles south to Los Angeles. The river had been the main source of water for what was once Owens Lake, which covered more than 100 square miles. The lake dried up, and then for much of the 20th century, it was the worst source of dust pollution in America, according to a 2020 study by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. When windstorms hit the dried lake bed, they pick up PM10, particulate matter 10 micrometers or smaller, which can lodge in the lungs when inhaled and has been linked to worsened asthma, heart attacks and premature deaths. The amount of PM10 in the air around Owens Lake has been as much as 138 times higher than deemed safe by the US Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. Local officials successfully sued the city of Los Angeles, arguing it had violated the rights of nearby communities to clean air. A judge ordered Los Angeles to reduce the dust. That was 25 years ago. Since then, the city of Los Angeles has spent $2.5 billion trying to keep wind from blowing dust off the lake bed. The city has tried different strategies, covering the lake bed in gravel, spraying just enough water on the dust to hold it in place, constantly tilling the dry earth, creating low ridges to catch restive dust particles before they can become airborne. The result is a mix between an industrial site and a science experiment. On a recent morning, workers scurried across the vast area checking valves and sprinklers that continually get plugged with sand. Nearby, inside a complex that resembles a bunker, walls of screens monitor data to alert the operation's 70-person staff if something goes wrong. If the carefully calibrated flow of sprinklers is disrupted, for example, dust could quickly start to fly off again. Dust levels near the lake still sometimes exceed federal safety rules, among Utah's coterie of nervous advocates for the Great Salt Lake. Owens Lake has become shorthand for the risk of failing to act quickly enough and the grave damage if the lake dries up, the contents of its bed spinning into the air. Of what used to be shore of what used to be Owens Lake is what's left of the town of Keeler. When the lake still existed, the town of Keeler was a boomtown. Today it consists of an abandoned school, an abandoned train station, a long-closed general store, a post office that's open from 10 a.m. to noon, and about 50 remaining residents who value their space and have lots of it. Cheap land, said Jim Macy when asked why he moved to Keeler in 1980. He described that period before Los Angeles began trying to hold down the lake bed as the time of dust. He recalled watching entire houses vanish from sight when the wind blew in. We called it the Keeler Death Cloud, Mr. Macy said.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has hosted the presidents of Turkey and Russia for the Astana process for Syria, which the Syrian foreign minister was then hosted by Iran a day later. One of the issues which was discussed, Turkey's possible military operation in northern Syria. Iran has voiced concern, with Iran's leader advising Turkey's presidents not to launch a new military operation. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Turkey will go ahead with this or not, and look at Syria's security situation, possible cooperation with Iran and Russia on combating terrorism, why Turkey has said that the U.S. feeds terrorist organizations and must leave east of the Euphrates in Syria. Our guests for this edition of The Spotlight are Jim Kavanaugh joins us. He's a founder of the Polemicist.net, joins us from New York. Also joining us is Tony Gosling, who's an investigative journalist, joining us from Bristol over in the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
To you both. Tony Gosling, really first start with you. You have the Iranian foreign minister who has expressed concern regarding this potential Turkish, some call it an invasion, some call it a military operation in Syria, northern part of that country, which Ankara might undertake under the pretext of fighting terrorists, of which it has said that it will do. How concerning is this situation in which Turkey wants to possibly go through with it at this point anyways?
Well, look, before I answer that question, I think it's important to point out that these are real talks going on, because I think what many countries have now realised, particularly those involved in these Middle East conflicts, is that in order to actually make any progress, the British and the Americans, and to a large extent, the European Union, have to be out of the room, because there really has been no progress in talks almost whatsoever with any of these power blocks. Who, I mean, to be frank with you, the British Empire went at the end of the Second World War. The Americans tried to take over, but they still cannot actually face the fact that the empire is crumbling, and everything that they're doing is in an attempt to re-establish or to stop these empire aims from disappearing. So, you've got to have the Americans out of the room if you're going to make any progress. So that's the reasons why we've got these three powers, even though, of course, Turkey is a NATO power, sitting down to have real conversations and real talks about how each of those countries, each of those factions, what happens in these situations? This is a bit of horse trading. The Turks will be saying, well, we want this, we want that. And the Russians will be saying, et cetera. And all the various parties will be having their say on Syria. And at the end of the talks, what we may well find is that some compromises have been made during those talks. Now, coming to your question, so at least we've got that as a prospect, which when you're in talks with the British and the Americans, that's very, very rarely the case. The diplomatic aspect of it is basically out of the door. The diplomats' hands are tied. I think, there will be some sort of progress on this, I would imagine, particularly because the Russians are in the room. Obviously, the Russians have got a big stake in Syria. Russia was largely the reason why the US empire failed in its attempt to overthrow President Assad. Main reason for that being the Tartus port, which is so crucial to projecting Russian military stabilizing power in the Mediterranean. We can't have a Mediterranean which is dominated by the Sixth Fleet and by NATO. That would be a disaster for many of the countries which rely on the balance of power being maintained in that part of the world. There's also the absolutely extraordinary situation of turning back ISIS and these proxy forces, mercenaries paid by the West and by NATO. Some Diliana Gatasheva, the investigative journalist, has proven that the arms that were going to ISIS were coming from the United States. They were just using fake end-use certificates. So this was an amazing success, really, in stopping the regime change in Syria over the last decade or so. Very, very concerted attempt by the Americans. And it's actually, in a way, it's comparable to something like the Battle of Stalingrad in the Second World War, where the Russians turned back the assault on their country, the Soviet Union, by the Nazis. Or even if you go back further to biblical times, you know, Paul's conversion from the Saul in Acts 9 in the Bible, the road on the road to Damascus, this massive conversion and this complete change in this individual who was persecuting the early Christians and turned around and then became one of their biggest advocates and, of course, wrote large parts of the New Testament after it. So it was an enormous, enormous turnaround in Syria. And so it's absolutely right to keep those people who were trying to institute regime change in Syria out of this and to slowly bring the Turks on side, I suppose, prize them away from the NATO alliance and to bring about some peace here through some real horse trading with these three main powers.
Sure. Well, Jim Kavanaugh, our guest there has opened up a topic there that is worth asking you then, the question of which, in the format of the Astana process, you have the Russian presidents, you have the Turkish president, and obviously the Iranian president, Iran being the host, of which you're having a diplomacy work there in terms of working out things wherein if you did have the U.S. or the British in the room, that things would not be at all going in a direction where there'd be any type of result. And maybe at the same time, in the same breath, I may ask you if you make a comparison to the way that the U.S. president visited West Asia or Middle East, as they call it, and not coming out with anything. At least here, you're having some tangible progress. You're having these leaders, the presidents meet Iran's leader. You're having an exchange of thoughts, and you're reaching some kind of direction as to where things may go. Is it appropriate to view it that way? Of course, I'd like to thank Tony Gosling for that perspective.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree that it's much more likely to be productive without the Americans and the British in the room. And, you know, you have the principals in this case, who are all serious people, and none of them are the kinds of poodles that the Europeans are to American imperialism. And so that's an important issue, and that opens up a possibility. What you do have is, first of all, let's make clear the Americans are still in the background on this. The Americans occupy a third of Syrian territory. They occupy oil fields and grain and agricultural fields that are very important, and they haven't given up on their regime change target yet. But you know, clearly that's not going to happen probably. And what they have been doing is preventing Syria from reconstructing, and they're going to continue to do that as long as they can. On the other hand, in terms of the principles in Astana, you have Erdogan, who is a smart cookie, and he works for himself. And he plays all sides, and look what he just did with NATO, you know. So he is going to, and he has, you know, on the backs of the Americans, and he came in and occupied part of Syrian territory. He's not going to give that up easily. Syria at some point, and the Russians, backed by the Russians, are going to have to decide what they're going to do about the American occupation, what they're going to do about the Turkish occupation. Now, as you know, Tony said, this kind of negotiation with these principals might come to some conclusion on that. But everybody now, I'm very suspicious because, you know, look at what Erdogan has done with NATO. With all the attention and all the cats away in Ukraine, you know, the mice can play in Syria. And it, I don't know what Erdogan is going to insist on or what Assad is going to insist on. He wants his territory back. He should have it. And what would he give to get Turkey out of it? What would Turkey take to get out of his territory? It's a tricky situation, but it's one which is kind of, for the moment, with the Astana process, has some possibilities of resolution because it's put the imperial masters to the side, at least for the moment and directly.
Well, it looks like there's a common goal here, Tony Gosling. Correct me if I'm wrong. When you have Turkey that even after meeting Iran's leader who said that, you know, this military incursion that you're going to make or take is not a good idea, it's actually going to help the terrorists and it's going to create instability. Meanwhile, Turkey has said, you know what, I need you, Russia and Iran, to support this Turkish operation in Syria with the common goal that we want to eliminate terrorists. Now, Turkey views the YPG militia as terrorists, okay? So are we seeing that there may be some cooperation there in order to stop Turkey, as it has been stated, to want to carve out that slice of northern Syria when Russia and Iran will come into the picture and aid Turkey in terrorist operations, if Russia and Iran, that is, decide to do so?
Well, they may well do so. And I think this is the steely test of these diplomats. They're able at these talks to actually do their job, as diplomats are actually very well trained to do it. Their hands are totally tied if they're British diplomats or US diplomats. But I think there's every possibility that we will see some sort of deal come out of this. It benefits everybody to reduce tensions. It benefits the Turks, it benefits the Syrians, benefits the Russians and Iran. All powers in the region would be really happy to see less and less tension, less and less the idea of sort of, you know, picking up arms, trying to grab more territory. And of course, one of the reasons that the Turks have been taking territory and the YPG have is as a bargaining chip. So this is where those bargaining chips come down on the casino table today. This is what they're there for. So they will be making concessions. I do believe that they're not simply there to steamroller through their views and ignore everybody else like the British and the Americans do in their talks. And in the background to this, we've got a much more confident Russia. Very important to see that the Russians now, I see Sergei Lavrov is now saying that the objectives in Ukraine are beyond the Donbass. So he's now, they've changed their tune a bit. They said they wanted to liberate the Donbass, and they're now saying, well, actually, it may be more than that. And of course, the Russians may not want more than that, but they're confident enough to say that they do want more than that in order to force Zelensky and the Ukrainians to the negotiating table. So that's the sort of thing the Russians, I think, are showing an example to the world here. What they're doing is they're saying, come to the table, come to the negotiating table. You know, the West, okay, the Americans, the British have refused to do that time and time again. I think we're with every possibility that we may see changed borders ultimately in Syria, a new lines drawn. But those negotiations are taking place now, and they're very real negotiations that may become let's not forget the actual Syrian people themselves. They want this over with. They want to return to a normal, peaceful life, and they may be able to get that if things go well at these talks.
Well, Jim Kavanaugh, so at least, you know, when it comes to Syria, we know what Russia wants. We know what Iran wants. And also we know the Turkish aim. Do we know what the U.S. wants? What is it doing in Syria?
Oh, it wants to keep, as I said, it wants to keep Syria from reconstruction. It wants to keep the Syrian government and society from unifying and from building itself up again. And it wants to keep Syria weak, you know, and it wanted to topple the government of Syria. It wanted to destroy the state. It didn't get away with that because the Russians intervened and interrupted it, although it's not over yet. And they are going to play the game. They're going to try and play Erdogan themselves in a certain way. I'm not as optimistic about Erdogan, and I don't know what the Turks want. I wouldn't say that. I think it would be on the table right away. The Russians and the Iranians will say to the Turks, oh, we'll keep down, we'll prevent the YPG from organizing and mobilizing, and we disarm them, etc., if you leave the territory. I don't know that Erdogan actually wants to leave. And I don't know that the Americans might be saying to Erdogan, you know, we might sit here and say, well, the Russians are showing their strength, but the Russians are also involved. They're occupied. They have things to do in Ukraine. And the Americans might be saying to the Turks, and Erdogan might be saying to himself, well, I can make moves now. And the Russians may not have the really want to get involved in something right here at this time while they're still not finished in Ukraine. So all of these variables are out there, and they make for a very interesting situation. And unfortunately, the victim in this is Syria, which is divided, which is occupied by various countries and various, and we don't have a clear sense of how that's going to end in a way that restores the territorial integrity and the unity of Syria and allows it to rebuild in a strong way. Iran wants that. Russia wants that. I don't know that Erdogan wants that, and the Americans certainly don't.
Well, Tony Gosling, so this is what Erdogan has said. He came out and said the U.S. feeds terrorist organizations and must leave east of the Euphrates in Syria. Obviously, he's talking about the U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters. So, in a sense, why doesn't Turkey address this issue with the U.S. and for the U.S. to make up its mind if it is tiptoeing the line of whether it's going to support Turkey or it's going to support these the Kurds that they used so much in the war against Syria?
Well, look, that's a great question, a really good question. And of course, what the answer to it is that the Americans are still using these terrorists as leverage in Turkey. Turkey's in a really unenviable position, being right in the middle of all of this between East and West, in the enormous tensions that there's been between the old Soviet, the Russians, and, well, they were Soviets, they're not anymore, the Russians and the West, including, of course, some of the ex-Soviet states in the West, and the Russian and American tensions in the Middle East. The Turks are right in the middle. And I think they are trying to play a game where they can play one off against each other. And I'm not sure that they're going to win that game. It seems pretty clear to me that, you know, you've got much, much bigger potential battles going on around the world. Just take a look at what's been happening in Taiwan, you know, between China and the US. The US seems to want to pick a fight with everybody. And the Turks, I think, have really got to make their mind up which side they're on. Of course, there is an attempt to, you know, harden the sides in these big international conflicts. The military use that terminology when they're preparing for a war. They don't want independent states, certainly not big ones like Turkey. So they really need to try to get the Turks on board with their plans for the Middle East. And also, of course, their plans to fight in Ukraine, which the Turks have not been so enthusiastic about. So, you know, you've got to see this in the wider context of the enormous tensions with Taiwan, with, you know, the Americans sailing a destroyer down through the Taiwan Straits and really, really annoying the Chinese. Now, of course, the problem with what's been going on in Ukraine in the background is that this has given the Chinese confidence. The Chinese are looking at the Russians and saying, well, if Russia could do this in the Donbass, maybe we can do this in Taiwan. And that could potentially be disastrous. You know, the Americans have said anything that happens in Taiwan, we're going to go all out to liberate it. So you've got the potential of a fuel of a much, much bigger, wider war between China and the US. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I think we need to bear these things in mind when we're talking about these, what Syria is now, a minor conflict. And, you know, if there was a wider war, there would be a big focus, I think, on the core of that would be this tension between Israel and Iran. And that's why it's so important to get Syria straightened out and these nations in the Middle East much more stable. Otherwise, that becomes a powder keg for the sort of core of this potential World War III between Iran and Israel, which, you know, that I think would become, you know, a much, much bigger problem in the future. So I'm not trying to, you know, prophesy here, predict the future, but I think we need to bear these much bigger bigger plans that I believe the United States has, because they are not going to just release their empire just like that. They want to, I think, use their military power before they go down, and we need to try and keep them in the box. And that's exactly what the Russians, the Turks and the Iranians are doing, talking about Syria today. Very important, and it'd be nice to see much more going on the wider sphere between, you know, between the Americans and the Americans, the big players in Ukraine, talking to the Russians. We need to have these talks. Otherwise, we're going to see, you know, I think, you know, potentially wider conflicts taking place that will dwarf what happened in Syria, and we really don't want that.
Well, Jim Cavanaugh, I'm still trying to get an answer on as to why the U.S. is in Syria. You gave some explanations there. There are other sides to the story behind the U.S. presence. One of them is the fact that the U.S. is aiding and abetting terrorists. Russia has come out and said that in and around that area that they're in. And they're moving actually troops interchangeably between Syria and Iraq. Because Iran has said if the U.S. withdraws itself from that area, then there is going to be a move towards stability. Then there will be a move towards this calming down. So in that regards, how do you see that happening? I mean, what do you see as chances of that happening? Or are we still looking at a prolonged presence? Because, again, it goes back to the question, what is the U.S. gain here?
Oh, I think there's very little chance of that happening from the U.S. In terms of the U.S. presence. The United States is going to stay there as long as it can. Look, the reason the United States went into Syria and wants to disrupt Syria and destroy the Syrian state, it's the same reason it wanted to destroy Libya and Iraq. This is the neocon program for destroying all the resistance states against Israel. And Syria was the stepping stone towards towards Iran. That was always the case. That was explicitly said, and it still is the case. So one of the things that, you know, we have to keep in mind is that not only Americans and the Turks, but the Israelis are bombing Syria every week, a couple of times a week. You know, there's a military attack going on in Syria. There's military occupation of the country and a military attack. And from the Obama administration, when they signed when Israel and the United States signed a secret agreement, essentially setting up a war council against Iran, that has been the program. So there's no question that the American game in Syria is part of the American game, the Israeli-driven American game against Iran. And we are in a situation, I think, you know, JCPOA negotiations are failing, and I think that we're in a situation, Israel wants an attack on Iran, and they want to create a situation in area in which that can happen and they can get away with it, and they need the Americans to go along with it. So that's got to be put into this, into our thinking about this, because that is the reason the Americans went into Syria, and sure. You know, because Syria was not doing anything to the United States. They were cooperating with the United States in a lot of ways, but they were part of the resistance actions sure. against Israel.
That 9 years of it, Tony Gosling, 9 years of a war in Syria, 9 years of the U.S. and its allies trying to get rid of their obsession with Assad, it didn't work. So I'm not too sure what track record the U.S. has to even want to think about pursuing that goal. And at the same time, we're looking at a different Russia. Our guest there talks about how Israel attacks Syria every other week. Well, you know, at this point, Russia is sanctioned off by the West. Israel, by default, has now gone along with the West when it comes to Russia, because obviously of what it's doing in Ukraine. So Russia has issued a few warnings to Israel about not attacking Syria. Are we looking at the possibility of the warnings turning into action by Russia when it comes to Israel attacking Syria?
Well, the obvious thing to do would be to shoot down an Israeli jet, wouldn't it? That's the obvious thing to do. That may happen. We shall see, particularly since the Russian S-400 system is pretty efficient at doing that kind of thing. So, I think that could happen at any time. I agree with Jim as well that we just heard there that this is really about Israel. That's why the Americans are there. They're doing it for Israel. And they've got a rather frightening Christian Zionist faction in the United States, an enormous faction that believes that what the Israelis do is God's will. This is quite frightening, with pastors like Hagee and others that believe that what Israel does is somehow, this is always going to be the right thing, that they can do no wrong. Now, this is also a very worrying faction. That is to say, the twisting and misuse of the Christian and other religions sure. in these conflicts. And that's why I think we need to be a very close eye
Thank you
on
for
the
that.
Middle East and how various religions are being used
Appreciate
and twisted
it.
In order to try and exacerbate Middle East conflicts.
Thank you. Sorry to jump in, Tony Gosling, fresh out of time, investigative journalist. Jim Kavanaugh, thank you, founder of thepolemicist.net. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tatvay and the team. It's goodbye until next time.